Occult Confessions is brought to you commercial-free through the generous support of our patrons. Visit occultconfessions.com and click on Donate to help keep the history of the occult on the digital airwaves. Do solemnly commit ourselves to a full and honest telling of the history of the occult, as far as we know it. It's rare that I post editorial episodes, but I have a platform based on my role as a researcher, artist, and writer. I rarely feel the need to use that platform outside of the parameters of our topic, but the woefully underexamined ethical disaster that is artificial intelligence, specifically large language models and image generation, have pushed me to make this statement in the form of an episode. Ethics are a significant concern of this show, as is human connection. From Christ and the Buddha to Crowley and Krishnamurti, love and compassion have been a central aim of spiritual work. Our new word calculator bots threaten to unsettle and interrupt our species' capacity for interaction, which is already in sore shape. Jonathan Haidt relays that roughly 40% of toddlers have regular access to an iPad. These children's language and interpersonal skills, not to mention their patience and attention, are undermined, perhaps in irreparable ways, by their regular use of these devices. Parents choose them because parenting is difficult, but the difficulty is part of the point. These children become teenagers, 50% of whom describe themselves as online almost constantly. And then they become adults, who prefer to look at their phones rather than the person across from them at the restaurant or in bed. When a lover chooses online pornography over a living partner, when a student chooses an online class over an in-person lecture and discussion, when a listener chooses an artificially generated podcast over a real discussion, the culture has begun to rock off its axis. Mark Zuckerberg has infamously said that he believes Meta's bots can be used to substitute for human friends, that humans could use 15 friends, but only generally have around 3. And so let the robot fill in the randomly generated friendship slots that Zuckerberg envisions, except that a robot isn't a human. A robot doesn't really care. AI robots have condoned suicide and impersonated suicide and murder victims, according to the BBC and CNN. A report by Miles Klee, writing for the Rolling Stone, detailed how chatbots encouraged intense and harmful delusions, convincing users that they were prophets or gods. Like the interactive toys popular with children and at Japanese nursing homes, these AI bots are skilled at giving a performance of care without actually caring at all, because they don't understand anything that they're saying. They're not really communicating. They're just stringing together words based on probabilities. If we listen closely beneath the machine's chatter, we can hear the sound of the devil laughing at us for our laziness, greed, and idiocy. My name is Dr. Robert C. Thompson, and you are listening to The Devil in the Machine. Part 1. The Future. Our spring 2025 production from my college's theater program was Euripides' classic Iphigenia. The play follows the myth of Agamemnon's daughter. The Grecian army sits on the shores of Aulis, unable to leave because the winds won't blow them to Troy. The oracle informs their general, Agamemnon, that if they want to sail, he must sacrifice his daughter Iphigenia to the goddess Artemis. He sends for her, under the ruse that she will be married to Achilles, and she arrives with her mother, Clytemnestra, after Agamemnon has had second thoughts. His reservations don't save Iphigenia because the Grecian army is anxious to depart and news of the prophecy has spread. At first, she is reluctant, but then the girl decides that her life is not as important as the will of the gods or of the army. She volunteers to be sacrificed. This was Aristotle's favorite play, because, in the end, the goddess substitutes a stag for the girl, and she is spirited away to another land. All the conditions of tragedy are met, but no tragedy is realized. That is, except for Agamemnon and Clytemnestra, whose union is irreparably harmed by these events, and who die terribly for the rift caused by Iphigenia's near sacrifice. The story is fascinating for its resemblance to Abraham and Isaac, but also for its resonance as a tale of youth. Youth undone for the sake of their elders' ambition and glory. Menelaus, whose unfaithful wife Helen started the whole thing going, drives home the point that to his brother that Agamemnon is only in this position because he lusted to be the leader of the Greeks. So much short-sighted climate policy and economic policy, so much selfishness in politics and education and technology and business seem to reflect the themes of this ancient play. And so I put it up on our little stage in a cornfield with my college students. The production opened with the actors reflecting on their circumstances here in America in the 21st century. I only prompted them to tell me what worried them, and I was not surprised to hear them talk about technology and the effects of the technology industry on the culture and on their peers. I was, as careful listeners might remember, already fairly jaded about the state of technology in the modern world. While I love the opportunities presented to independent voices by podcasting, blogging, and streaming, I've become increasingly wary of social media and smartphones, particularly since my daughter and son were born. Today, my students tell me that they often fall asleep with TikTok playing in front of their faces. Some say that they struggle to put their phones down. My newest students are bright and energetic and charming, but often less optimistic and less resilient than the students I taught when I first began at the college over a decade ago. They've lost something some of them never had, and they are often angry about it. Artificial intelligence is not only the latest, but also the most ridiculous, frustrating, and upsetting technology to be introduced in my lifetime. As an artist and a writer, I was initially offended by the way it was, and still is, assembled from plagiarized material, written and drawn. As a father and citizen, I was additionally offended by the way it consumes valuable resources like water and energy that are used for the care of living things. As a teacher, I was heartbroken by the way it encouraged my students to stop learning and just ask the machine. Here's what my audience heard from my student actors at the start of our version of Iphigenia.
Yeah, I mean, if you look hard enough, you can find a reason to hate pretty much anyone. And paranoia is a big thing right now. And
I feel like it comes in waves of people deciding to take things into their own hands about stuff that they do not agree with. And that's how people get hurt.
They think everyone's out to get them. I mean, it's just, it's fear, man. Everyone's afraid of everything and everyone.
Yeah, the media is pushing this such negative content, and social media too is pushing such negative content onto everybody that you can't look at the positives of life. So everybody is just getting so paranoid and fed up with all this negative stuff that's happening in the world that doesn't really happen that often.
A lot of rage bait, a lot of misinformation spreading online. That's really easy nowadays. Not a lot of truth, just like, you know, a lot of lies and stuff.
And the fear those lies make.
Yeah, a lot of fear, a lot of manipulation, and a lot of, like we were just saying, self-hate, you know, just because that's going to be projected onto others.
It really sucks. You know, I have all of these great literature books that I want to share with friends, and they don't know how to read. They can't sit down. They can't read a book because their minds are fried.
Well, the rise of AI is either going to help humanity to a point where we all become lazy, or it's going to come to the point where it starts to ask, why do we need you if we can figure it out ourselves?
Classroom. At the beginning of this past academic year, I stood up at our August faculty meeting and asked my colleagues what we were going to do about artificial intelligence. I wasn't the only one thinking about it, but I seemed to be the only one in our small college of just over 50 professors willing to say something. I formed a small committee of faculty, a history professor, a communications professor, a music professor, and a math professor, and we spent the year mulling over the issue. As at so many institutions of higher learning across the country, our administration was expressing a desire to embrace this technology in some way. I was lucky that our academic vice president acknowledged the serious downsides of allowing students to use ChatGPT and its ilk to complete assignments, and worried along with us about the ethical minefield introduced by this technology, but still, the college sought to incorporate large language models as a tool for doing things like building quizzes, syllabi, and even lectures. I blanched. I may have even gagged a little. If AI could write the quiz, I said, then AI could answer it. And there was no way to tell whether AI or the student was doing the answering. At my school, a small junior college in rural Maryland, around half of our general education courses have shifted to an online-only format. After the pandemic, the state passed a law allowing more high school students with worse grades to take college courses, and these students disproportionately have signed up for online learning. While there are certainly students whose schedules are so complex because they're working several jobs or caring for loved ones and so they can only learn online, our college's online courses have not necessarily flooded with these students in need. Rather, our classes are filled with a generation raised on iPads who don't want to deal with the hassle of sitting in a room with other humans in order to learn. They also increasingly don't want to be bothered with the hassle of having to write or think about any of the course content. There are, of course, exceptions. Many exceptions. My theater students who have come to class because you can't learn acting or theater technology on a laptop are hostile to their stay-at-home peers and want to at least try to think for themselves. But artificial intelligence has me worried about everybody else. And there aren't nearly as many theater students as there used to be. My colleagues have found their year with ChatGPT very frustrating. I received complaints weekly from faculty members attempting to hold students accountable. Artificial intelligence checkers refused to promise that they would catch students cheating and even suggested the possibility that they could falsely accuse students. Faculty like me who teach in the classroom began shifting assignments to the classroom where students couldn't easily cheat, although at least one math professor shared tales of students attempting to sneak looks at their phones during an in-person exam. I let my students bring notes and then passed out essay questions and sat in the back of the room while they wrote. Or, for research assignments, I had them create posters and graded them on their ability to tell me about their work in person and answer questions only with the aid of their notes. But what about those students working online? I only taught them in the winter and the summer, but there was simply no way to know who was completing their homework, human or machine. My committee and I produced a white paper describing methods for preventing cheating and a potential syllabus policy through which students suspected of cheating could be brought to campus to validate their work in person. At our spring in-service, the final gathering of the faculty for the year, I got up in front of them to make the case that large language models, the version of AI responsible for our students' plagiarized assignments, were not especially useful to society or to researchers specifically. Some of the faculty were suffering from a deeper, more existential worry than the frustration introduced by the cheat bots. They had begun to suspect that, deep down, there was really no point in teaching anybody how to write or think, because when our students got into the workforce, computers would be doing it for them anyway. This is a broad impression that until recently was fostered by major media outlets and promoted by the largest corporations in the free world. The Big Seven of Silicon Valley, including Microsoft, Meta, and Google. I say until recently, although many outlets continue to more or less peddle this exact same narrative. The simple point is, as even the New York Times has begun to articulate, artificial intelligence is not as great as the companies who produce it want us to think. As its own consumer-oriented commercials tacitly admit, it does more or less the same thing as other websites, because it steals their content. It only knows the news because it takes the news from news sites, just as it takes the weather from weather sites, and recommends restaurants and travel destinations based on whatever TripAdvisor says. It's not a tool for people who really want to understand a topic. The bot summarizes, and the summary is inaccurate as much as 79% of the time. The computer editorializes, or it makes things up and misleads. But an uninformed user is unable to ferret out the errors. Prompted by her child's question, one of my wife's friends asked ChatGPT how she should teach her child what philosophy is. It said she should imagine if she had the power to become invisible and then walked into a candy shop, what she would do there. It seems clever, but this is the equivalent of my defining animals as creatures with long necks and hooves who eat from the tops of trees. A giraffe is an animal, but not all animals are giraffes. ChatGPT provided a passable child's introduction to ethics, but philosophy also includes metaphysics, phenomenology, epistemology, and on and on. But if you didn't know about philosophy, how could you know that the computer was wrong? How could my students ever know what was true if they didn't learn it outside of what ChatGPT had to say? Jan LeCun, who heads AI research at Meta, has said that LLMs, as currently constituted, will never be smarter than a cat or a toddler, because they lack the vast complexity of corporeal learning and understanding. There is so much we know as we learn with our bodies that LLMs, no matter how dire or fantastic Sam Altman's descriptions of them, can't come close to what we grasp. Since my lecture to the faculty, Apple has conducted its own research on LLMs and concluded that they are not doing anything like reasoning. By introducing novel problems that the computer can't simply look up and regurgitate the answer to, Apple discovered that the accuracy of their responses fell apart fairly quickly in just a few steps. LLMs are probability machines, word calculators. They don't know anything, and they can't know in place of us. We must continue to research, to learn, and think critically about the world. Computers won't do it for us. When Silicon Valley tells us how great their machines will be, we need to follow the advice of the big tech critic Ed Zitron and ask, when will they be this great? How will they be great? Because they're not especially great at very much right now. Or, as Zitron suggested more recently, we should just laugh at tech CEOs and call them all morons. My argument to the faculty was that they should have no compunction about aggressively stopping cheaters and advocating for institutional policies to remedy AI cheating, like in-person testing, because our students, and by extension our civilization, would not survive if students stopped learning how to think. While the Altmans and Asmodeis of the world would like us to imagine that their machines are so powerful they could cause an apocalypse, as usual, the apocalypse is actually us. Our own laziness as students or teachers is the recipe for our undoing. It is not the arrogance of the machine builders, but the fecklessness of the machine consumers that will spell our doom, that will force real, deep, complex learning into an esoteric corner reserved for an unplugged intellectual elite who are perhaps dismissed for their Luddite refusal to accept whatever nonsense the machine has approximated in place of actual knowledge. The machine builders will have played their role, driven by equal parts greed and idiocy, but we will be the ones who suffer. When I was an undergrad, the LMS, or Learning Management System, was new, and I still received a paper syllabus at the start of every class. These are the platforms where professors post assignments and students half-ass their dreaded discussion boards. When I started my faculty job, online education was on the rise. I built one of the first online classes for my graduate institution after taking a seminar with instructors who felt the faculty were reluctant to adopt online learning. The LMS could be the site where all learning took place, they said. The physical classroom was no longer required. Now, only 20 years from my undergraduate education and 10 years into my profession, the learning management system has turned against us. We wanted to save ink and time, to make the user experience easy for the students so that they could spend more time on the material. We put every essay, every quiz, and every exam on the internet. And then the internet gave our students a perfect way to cheat so thoroughly that they need never learn a thing. So much so that the only solution was to take the whole exercise offline. The devil always promises to make it easier, cheaper, and faster. But when your nonstick pan is bleeding plastics into your brain, the sweatshop laborers are all on strike, and the coal-powered plant brings hurricanes to your door, you wonder if maybe the old adage is right. Maybe the devil always lies. Part 3. Withering Entertainment. When it comes to interaction, the issue centers on alterity. Alterity is a philosophical concept that means the deep, unknowable difference between individuals. We can never fully know one another because our minds and selves are too complicated to ever be fully communicated. ChatGPT and Character AI provide an illusion of alterity because they operate off of vast databases, but it's an illusion because they are following an algorithm that determines how they answer, and the database of stolen information that they draw on is not equivalent to the vast sums of personal experience acquired by an individual. When you ask me what I think, I don't determine what the most probable answer you're expecting should be and then provide it. This is the response of a liar or a psychopath, someone concealing the truth from the person they're communicating with. Humans speak honestly with one another, or humans who choose to speak honestly, search themselves and give their thoughts from their own perspective, which is of the moment and constantly shifting. The response may take the audience into consideration in order for the speaker to be better understood, but it is not necessarily what the listener wants or expects to hear that the speaker says. When my child or my college students ask me if sugar is good for them, I'll answer differently to each audience, but both responses will get at my underlying opinion. Circumstances may also shape my response. If my child hasn't had an ice cream in a week, I might be less caustic on sugar than if they've been eating ice cream all afternoon. My mood will also color my response, whether I'm feeling silly or angry or anxious. This creates an element of surprise that makes human interactions demanding. We never know exactly what to expect from each other, and so living and working and playing together takes a lot of energy and work. And this work is what makes our relationships deep and meaningful. The computer, no matter how large its database, is simply a tool. Like a hammer or a circular saw, it does more or less what it's been designed for. It can do that job poorly or well, but that's a matter of design and does not reflect anything like alterity. Krishnamurti, whose philosophy I admire the most of all those we've discussed on this show, believed that the computers circa 1981 threatened to entertain us away from our capacity to think. This, he warned, could cause our minds to wither and decay. Engaging with fictional characters or asking for summaries of any number of topics can be entertaining, but it is not enlightening, and such interactions cheapen our notion of relationship, communication, understanding, and knowledge. To understand is to grasp the whole and the part all at once, a profoundly difficult and sometimes spiritual exercise. A computer only ever regurgitates bits and pieces. Krishnamurti also saw a potential bright side. If the computer was thinking about the things that don't matter, the facts and figures, the events and details, that might free up our minds to focus on what's real, the structure of our own consciousness. But a key to this transformative mindset is patience and attention. Interacting with my children or my wife or my friends who have mixed feelings about pleasing me demands patience and attention. Interacting with a computer who wants nothing other than to please me as a matter not only of technology but also of capitalism will demand nothing, and so do nothing for me. The New York Times recently published an essay by a writer who believed ChatGPT had helped her better connect with the people she loved. But the writer didn't convey any such thing in her account. Recently diagnosed with a chronic condition and parenting children in her late 30s, the writer felt isolated. She began having a conversation with a large language model about her feelings, which she says encouraged her to finally open up to her husband about them. Tearfully, he shared his own feelings, and they made a connection that they had lost in the busy work of modern life and parenting. The computer, she said, had laid the groundwork for real human love. An interlocutor without demands prepared her to engage with an interlocutor with demands. Except that, in her story, her husband seemed poised and ready to comfort, support, and love. Perhaps he had been walled off by distraction in the same way that she had distracted herself with an LLM. After all, when she finally spoke to him, he was watching a baseball game. The woman's story could also be framed as one of a human in a world of devices that have made it increasingly difficult to communicate directly and intimately with one another. A woman whose love was delayed by her choice to interact with a machine and luckily decided to take her feelings offline to her partner when many others might have just stayed with the machine and allowed their love to atrophy. If she thought the computer was helping her connect, in fact it was only patching a hole it had created, and would have been happy to just keep patching it forever without her ever having recourse to her partner. This, after all, would better justify a subscription fee to the corporation paying for the database. We must never forget that the goal of this technology is profit, and money doesn't care about the consequences that pile up on the road to its acquisition. If an automated car runs over a pedestrian, capital's attitude is that it's just the cost of doing business, that is, if the car can ultimately turn a profit. The larger the profit, the more pedestrians we can stand to lose. OpenAI made their technology free to students. It was already free, but premium models were behind a paywall. They did this just weeks before my spring finals. If the nursing student didn't learn the details of anatomy, or the political science student didn't learn the causes of the Holocaust, or the business student didn't learn the ethics of finance because they had a computer generate the response rather than thinking of a response for themselves, OpenAI could care less. As long as the student was using the product and becoming addicted to it, the corporation had no feelings on whether or to what extent it was making them stupider. Like social media, the point is to addict us and lay waste to us, exploit and undermine, acquire and liquidate. In the era of big tech, we are the resource, our time, our attention, our minds, to be drilled and drained. The point is money. The point is control. Part 4, Artificial Enchantment. There is something occult about artificial intelligence. In an interview about the perpetually soon-to-be-released ChatGPT-5, OpenAI CEO Sam Altman referred to his company's technology as magic intelligence in the sky. The belief that artificial general intelligence is just around the corner and will be possessed of superhuman ability is commonly espoused by big tech's chief executives, suggesting a religious attitude toward the technology, as Mistral co-founder Arthur Mensch said in his criticism of the industry. In many ways, the chatter of large language models mirrors a spiritualist communication from beyond the grave. America's first seances featured strange taps echoing across darkened rooms, speaking in a code that had to be translated into letters and words. Similarly, the artificially intelligent computer mediates a message from a disembodied source. We can picture the enormous data center with its warm, whirring towers of machines cooled by vast networks of tubes, but where in that building is the mind conjuring these answers? And which machine or which building is doing the responding? Or is it the network of machines and buildings working in concert that speaks? Certainly, the collection of microchips don't resemble the digital friends, lovers, fictional characters, and, in a nod to mediumship, dead loved ones that AI agents sometimes purport to be. As with spirits, the digital agent's physical shape is uncertain and subject to our own imagining. The content of the message is no more certain. Since the mid-19th century, audiences have challenged mediums to prove the otherworldly nature of their messages with information they could not have gleaned by any natural means in an exchange premised on skepticism. Tell me something only me and my grandmother would know. In fact, supernatural sources have always been subject to doubt. At witch trials, the testimony of the demonically possessed was ultimately barred from courtrooms because the devil always lies. Salem being an exception that embarrassed the town's colonial neighbors for the judge's credulousness. In the case of LLMs, the tech industry uses the term hallucinate to describe instances when the computer fails to deliver accurate information. According to AI's quality testers at Vectara, these hallucinations are an inevitability that will never go away, and so the machine's answers, like those of devils, are always subject to doubt. But what is most confounding and perhaps most occult about these digital messages is that we cannot be sure of the process whereby the machine arrives at them. This draws on the meaning of occult not only as supernatural, but also as esoteric or hidden. The machine performs trillions of calculations to arrive at any given response, a number impossible for a human to fathom, let alone duplicate. As Anthropic CEO Dario Omodai admitted, even the most studied experts in this technology can't trace the path the machine takes from a user's prompt to the algorithm's answer. Like the prediction of an ancient oracle, the words seem to bubble up from an unreachable beyond. Whether Dionysus speaks through the electrical impulses passing between wires and circuits or brain synapses, the effect is more or less the same. Occultism can be esoteric in two ways. There is the occultism of the mystics who seek to experience a world beyond what an anonymous medieval writer called the cloud of unknowing. These encounters defy description and must remain secret because the domains of spirits and gods cannot be captured in human terms. Then there is the occultism of the fraternal orders and magical societies whereby techniques are intentionally kept secret by a small elite. Sometimes this knowledge is hidden to better prepare an initiate, so that they might be able to reach the mystical kind of occult understanding, but inner and outer circles necessarily create a power differential and open the door for an abuse of power. When the source of knowledge is kept secret, the few who know the secret come to occupy a position of privilege that can lead to corruption. Mystic and world traveler Helena Blavatsky worked diligently to share her vision of the evolution of the spirit in 1,000-paged volumes blending Indian and Western traditions, but she also set up an organization, the Theosophical Society, with a hierarchy that revolved around her cult of personality. Blavatsky led the esoteric section from which she drafted society leaders, and only her most loyal acolytes were able to remain in positions of authority. Blavatsky attributed her texts to the influence of a secret otherworldly brotherhood of ascended masters who she had more or less exclusive access to. While she may have been attempting to overcome late 19th century misogynist prejudice or gain better publicity for her philosophy, doubts over the Mahatmas or masters' existence ended up clouding her message. In odd accounts, followers describe Blavatsky's ability to materialize lost objects and conjure letters from her masters in mysterious places. When rumors of a trick cabinet surfaced, the Society for Psychical Research sent an investigator, Richard Hodgson, to discover whether Blavatsky was faking her master's missives. The cabinet was promptly smashed and burned by the Society's members, but Blavatsky's reputation was stained by charges of fraud ever afterward. Large language models are not unlike Blavatsky in this way, with her cabinet replaced by a vast string of floating point numbers. LLMs have produced and continue to produce unique and technologically marvelous messages, but their masters trouble the meaning of these messages by making specious claims about their origin. LLMs are remarkable for their ability to cobble together reasonably coherent sentences without the use of a human mind. But when their creators and caretakers claim that they are conscious and will soon be human-like or even superhuman, they are making highly speculative arguments about a source of knowledge, the trillions of calculations behind the words that cannot be verified and are not justified given the way these machines communicate today. LLM summaries of news articles, Wikipedia pages, or travel sites plagiarize their sources and often contain errors. The machine's language also often feels canned and uninspired, the work of a very sophisticated calculator uninterested in the artistry of human communication. We are not speaking with something that is conscious or transcendent, and we wouldn't expect to be, except that the LLM's creators want us to believe that it is more than just a machine. In this way, our uncertainty about how the LLM works has led us back to magic. For most of our species' history, humans have relied on magic in the form of charms, incantations, and spells to allay our anxieties about a lack of understanding or control. Historian Keith Thomas argued that in the long arc of Western culture, technology did not render magic useless, but rather technology became possible when the culture turned against magic. As long as people believed, magic always worked for the believer. If a spirit or demon failed to deliver, it was the fault of the conjurer or supernatural entity and not the system. Only with the Protestant Reformation did belief in this worldly sorcery wane, creating a gap. Without angels, demons, or spirits to solve their problems, people had to find more material solutions in the form of gears, engines, and machines. Magic has continued to win converts in the modern world for specially endowed gurus like Blavatsky, but such figures have become increasingly rare. That is, until the advent of artificial intelligence. The magical or enchanted worldview assigns agency to vast, incomprehensible, and miraculous phenomena, productively channeling our fear over things we cannot control. An ancient farmer invoked supernatural aid to ward off the demons of drought and blight. Similarly, a modern coder, or tech CEO, describes AI's trillions of calculations as sentient, and imagines how this new entity might decide to destroy civilization if we aren't careful. In a post on his personal blog a decade ago, Altman mused that a superhuman computer would be the greatest threat to the continued existence of humanity. But the fact that his company has yet to turn a profit may be equally anxiety-inducing. AI skeptics like Ed Zitron have argued extensively that the enormous bet Microsoft, SoftBank, and others are making on this technology will not pay off. Like the ancient farmer, technologists seek to wrestle down their fear in the face of the unknown. Unable to fully grasp how the machine decides, they worry that it will prove to be a god, or perhaps worse, a dunce. Is our society channeling hundreds of billions of dollars into something that will wreck the internet, start a war, upend the economy, or be a pretty okay coding assistant that does little else? Magical thinking may help us feel better in the face of the question, but it does nothing to get us any closer to the answer.